I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Kids are like sponges, and when they grow up absorbing a stressful environment, it can become toxic. Even after the stress is removed, the damage can last for years. Today we'll hear the latest thinking on how abuse, neglect, and trauma can stymie a child's development and literally change the shape of our brains. Then, whether it's to dispense wisdom, provide solace, or just to prove a point, everyone has their favorite quotations. In our second half, we'll want to hear yours. We'll discuss them with the editor of Bartlett's Familiar Quotations. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. We've long known that stress is bad for kids. What we're only beginning to understand is just how bad it is. Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris is among the pioneers of a new way of looking at health in terms of the devastating impact that abuse, neglect, divorce, parental addiction, or mental illness can have on our kids. That impact can be long-lasting, and it can even change the shape of our brains. Dr. Burke-Harris writes about this in a new book, The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. She's the founder and CEO of the Center for Youth Wellness in San Francisco, and she joins us this morning from the studios of KQED. And Dr. Burke-Harris, so nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this notion that trauma may be more devastating than we thought, what's the consequence of that? What are you finding out?
Well, this information, we actually learned a great deal from a study that was done by the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, and Kaiser Permanente, where they asked more than 17,000 adults about their histories of exposure to childhood adversity, and then looked at their health consequences. And the thing that was really surprising about this study that was done now 20 years ago was that not only did high degrees of exposure to childhood adversity affect things like risk of depression and substance use and alcoholism, it also dramatically increased the risk for health problems. Hmm. So for folks who had four or more of the 10 categories of adverse childhood experiences that they looked at, their risk for heart disease was double. For stroke was 2.5 times. For chronic lung disease was almost 4 times. And that is what has sparked this field of research about how is it that adversity in childhood gets under our skin and changes our biology.
Are you finding that four of these ACEs, you call them, adverse childhood experiences, is four something like the magic number now?
Well, four is the number where we really see this dramatic increase in 7 out of 10 of the leading causes of death in the United States. So it's really this threshold that seems to be very significant clinically. And, you know, more research is happening as to the effect of folks who have fewer than four. But what we see is that the more you have, the greater your health risks are.
You know, you've had any number of patients in your clinic over the years who got you thinking about the impact of this idea of toxic stress and lifelong illness. But one of them was a boy named Diego. Tell us about him.
Diego was seven years old the first time his mom brought him to see me. And she brought him to see me because his teacher had told her that she believed that Diego had ADHD, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and she wanted me to give him a prescription for Ritalin. But when I did what I was trained to do, and I did a thorough history and physical, what I found as I was examining this child was a number of things. Number one, yes, he was having these behavior problems, but he also had other health problems. He had asthma, he had eczema, or dry or inflamed skin. And he was also little, really little.
He had stopped growing, literally, right?
Yes, that's right. So his height was average for a four-year-old child. And when I looked into his medical records from the previous doctor who had seen him and also talked to mom about his history, when I asked mom, when did she notice that his behavior problems really started? She became tearful, and I actually had to have Diego wait in the waiting room with my medical assistant. And what she told me was that Diego had experienced a sexual assault when he was 4 years old. And looking at all of his symptoms, I was able to piece together that this sexual assault had not only been psychologically and emotionally terrifying and damaging for him, but actually it was a trigger that changed his biology and interfered with his growth.
Wow. So what's this distinction that you've made between normal stress that everybody seems to experience all the time or regularly, and this notion of toxic stress? What are we talking about here?
Well, after seeing Diego and other patients like him, I really began to dive into the science about how early adversity affects our biology. And what we learned from the National Scientific Council on the Developing Child is that there are three ways in which our bodies can respond to stress. There's the positive stress response. That's our body's response to normal everyday stress. It's what gets us up in the morning focused. If we don't care about, you know, how we're going to do on that test, we'll probably fail. So that's normal and healthy. There's something called a tolerable stress response, which is when kids are exposed to more severe stressors like a natural disaster or the death of a loved one. But they are able to get safe, stable, and nurturing relationships, which the science shows us actually buffer the biological stress response. Mm-hmm. And that's differentiated from what the American Academy of Pediatrics now calls toxic stress. And this is the way our bodies respond to severe or prolonged stressors without the nurturing buffering of caring, loving relationships. Mm. And what we see is that a child's fight or flight response, when their body releases hormones like adrenaline and cortisol, over periods of time, it actually can become overactive and have difficulty turning itself off. And this is what leads to long-term changes to the structure and function of children's brains, their hormonal systems, their immune system, and even the way their DNA is read and transcribed.
And I gather that what you're finding, and maybe I'm reading too much here, but the notion here is that this is happening to our kids at far greater rates than maybe we've thought about for a long time.
That's exactly right. So the adverse childhood experiences study was published by the CDC and Kaiser two decades ago. And in that time, scientists, people like myself, doctors, have looked into this a lot more. And what we realize now is that there are almost 35 million children in the United States that have experienced at least one adverse childhood experience. And in fact, the original study that looked at adults found that 2/3 of the adults that they surveyed had experienced at least one adverse childhood experience, and 1 in 8 folks had experienced 4 or more. And so when we consider the health risk, we're beginning to understand now that adverse childhood experiences represent a major public health threat.
So 1 in 8 are hitting that threshold of 4 that you're finding is proving to be a significant number here.
Yeah, that's right. So if you think about the idea that 1 in 8 folks have double or more the risk for 7 out of 10 of the leading causes of death because of their exposure to adversity in childhood, it gives you a sense of the scope of the problem.
Wow. Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris is my guest. Her new book, The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. We're talking about the impact of long-term stress on our kids. You know, Diego wasn't the only child who got you thinking more deeply about the impact of toxic stress. Monisha Sullivan was 16 when she first visited you and your clinic a few days before Christmas. It was back in 2008. She's an African-American teenage mother at the time who had grown up in the poorest and most violent neighborhood in San Francisco. Monisha Sullivan got you thinking, too.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So Monisha was a patient who was, when she came in to see me, interestingly, it was, you know, she was supposed to get her regular vaccines, right? I was, just going to give her her shots.
Right.
And when I went to give her her shots, she had an extreme reaction, an extreme fear response. And what I was observing in that situation was that she was just had an overactive stress response. And that was actually part of what got me into understanding. I mean, I could see it in the exam room that when faced with a scary situation, her stress response was, higher than average. And the question that led me to think was, okay, so if that is caused by stress hormones that are activated in her body, how is that affecting her ability to sit in a classroom and learn? How is that affecting her her biology or even her reaction to her child when she's parenting and her child does something that she doesn't understand or is upsetting or scary to her, right? Mm-hmm. And understanding how we can use this framework to address the underlying problem, which is an overactive stress response, was really, it really shaped my not only my medical practice, but actually my career, because I've been dedicated to finding solutions to toxic stress. And that's why I wrote The Deepest Well, because what we understand now is that there is a lot that we can do to improve the health and improve the lives of kids who are struggling with the long-term effects of childhood adversity.
I was going to say, in fact, at the time of Monisha's visit, you had been starting to think more deeply about the difficulties some of our kids are facing out there. In fact, in a profile of you in The New Yorker, that profile said you had just started having a crisis of confidence in the work you were doing. How so?
Yeah, well, it felt like, so, I did my residency training in pediatrics at Stanford. I did a master's in public health at Harvard. And I felt like I learned there that if we want to improve the health of vulnerable communities, what we have to do is we have to provide access and we have to do kind of the standard public health playbook, right? Mm-hmm. Work on nutrition, work on immunizations, all of these things. And yet this research about adverse childhood experiences tells me that these are not necessarily the only things that are killing our kids, right? There is this huge, huge issue of childhood adversity that I was never trained to deal with in medical school or residency. And yet that was the absolute biggest threat to the health of my patients. And that's why I created the Center for Youth Wellness to look at this issue of adverse childhood experiences and toxic stress and develop solutions, focus my time, my energy, and bring together a team to figure out how do we address this and how do we improve the health of kids.
And so today then, to what extent is the medical community broadly adapting this view that ongoing serious trauma and stress has this enormously negative impact on our children?
I would say more and more folks are beginning to recognize this issue, and more of my colleagues are awakening to the issues of adverse childhood experiences and toxic stress.
Are they too slow?
We're way behind. We're way behind. Right now, even though this research was published 20 years ago, only 4% of pediatricians are actually screening for adverse childhood experiences as part of the routine health exam for kids. And that needs to change. Every pediatrician in America should be screening for adverse childhood experiences as part of the regular physical.
So what are we learning then about the direct impact of repeated trauma, this toxic stress you're talking about, doctor, on the actual shape of the brains of children?
What we're learning is that these high doses of stress hormones and the activation of parts of the brain, including when kids experience something scary, right? It activates our fight or flight response, and that releases stress hormones, and it also activates the amygdala, which is the part of the brain that is our fear center. And what happens is that our amygdala actually sends neurons, it sends brain cells that project to the prefrontal cortex, which is the part of our brain responsible for executive functioning, judgment, impulse control, all of the things that a child needs to be able to sit in a classroom and learn. And the more scary experiences that a child has, the more the amygdala turns down the functioning of the prefrontal cortex. Because what you know, in a terrifying situation, you want to be, you know, reactive and you want to fight back, right? Like that's what our fight or flight response was designed for. And so it makes sense that we would turn down executive functioning. But the problem is for a child who's experiencing a lot of adversity, they need that functioning of their prefrontal cortex to sit in a classroom and learn. And we also see changes in the hippocampus, the part of the brain that's responsible for learning and memory, right? And these changes can be long-lasting. We can actually see changes in brain architecture with the amygdala, the fear response center, becoming larger, actually. We can see that on MRI. We can see decreased functioning of the prefrontal cortex, and we see decreased functioning of the hippocampus. And these are things that we can see on functional MRI.
So long-lasting and even permanent then, perhaps?
Well, here's the thing. This is what's really exciting. So more recent research has shown that with early detection and early intervention, we can actually reverse some of these structural changes in the brain. And there was actually just a randomized controlled trial that was published in 2015 that for kids who experienced early adversity, who were randomized into high-quality nurturant caregiving, their MRIs actually looked like kids who had never been maltreated, as opposed to the kids who, unfortunately, were randomized into the arm of the study where they didn't get high-quality nurturing caregiving. So actually, relationships are healing to brain architecture.
You tell a really cool story about talking to kids about their misbehavior in the classroom and explaining to them that part of the issue here is what they've been through, what they've had to been forced to absorb in the course of their lives through toxic stress and one exposure after another might be the bigger factor here. And their reaction sometimes is, "You mean to tell me, doctor, I'm not crazy?"
That's right. A lot of these kids have been told that they're the problem.
Yeah.
That they have bad behavior, they're bad kids. And what I say to my young people, especially my adolescents, I say to them, because of what you've experienced, your body is releasing more stress hormones than the average person. And that can look and feel like having trouble controlling your impulses, being quick to anger, or getting sick easily when you feel overwhelmed. And they do. This wave of relief crosses their face. And the first thing they say is, "You mean I'm not crazy?" It's really important Wow. for these young people to understand, actually, this is your body trying to take care of you because of everything that you've been through. You know, your fight or flight response is designed to protect you. But sometimes, because of what you've been through, it may be overactive and that may not be helping you anymore. So you need to learn how to recognize when it's there to help you or when it's doing its job a little too well and you actually don't need to respond.
Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris's new book, The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. So to wrap this up, we need to do what about this? The path forward is what? And I know you talk about screening and the need to make it more accessible and more commonplace. What do you mean screening and what are we talking about there?
Well, at the Center for Youth Wellness, we've developed a very simple screening tool that can be done in 3 minutes or less as part of the regular physical exam. And any pediatrician in the country can get access to this tool on our website, nppcaces.com. NPAC.org, we've developed something called the National Pediatric Practice Community on ACE Screening. And any pediatrician can get access to not only the tools, but also, you know, resources about what do you do when you identify that a patient has had ACEs? What are the most effective interventions? So all of that is available on our website. The other piece, of course, is that when it comes to adverse childhood experiences, one of the most important things that we can do is simply raising national awareness. Because once we know better, we can do better. A lot of parents say to me, oh, those things happened to my child, but it happened when they were little. They don't even remember. And so it's not affecting them. And what we understand is that the younger a child is, actually, the greater the impact that it has on their brain structure and their brain architecture. So this is really important information to share with parents, to share with educators, to share with policymakers. Every single one of us has a role to play in changing the way our society responds to adverse childhood experiences.
The average person out there deals with stress how, doctor? We have certain tools that we use. We have other people we can fall back on. Tell us about that.
Certainly, yeah. So one of the things that I actually recommend in the deepest well is some of the tools that we know are evidence-based and effective. Things like getting regular exercise, right? At least, you know, an hour a day of regular exercise. Healthy sleep and having good sleep hygiene. Mental health intervention. Things like, you know, calling that therapist. Mental health, it still works, right?
Yeah.
Things like mindfulness or meditation, as well as healthy relationships and good nutrition. These are some of the things that I outline in the deepest well as showing the evidence of how these things can reduce stress hormones, reduce inflammation, and enhance neuroplasticity, which is our brain's ability to make new connections in response to our environment.
Okay, that's Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, her new book, The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. Obviously, she's doing very important work out in the Bay Area. Doctor, sure appreciate your time, and we wish you the best of luck in the work you're doing.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure, you bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk with the editor of Bartlett's Familiar Quotations, and we'll want to know what your favorite quotes are, too, that have been meaningful to you over the course of your lives. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week on the show, we spoke to Grammy Award-winning opera singer and Prairie Village native Joyce DiDonato about her work bringing music to prisoners. Hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date, where you can find all of our episodes in podcast form. On tomorrow's show, we look at how and why a neighborhood suffers without a grocery store, and a conversation about what causes some local counties to rank so much higher than others when it comes to residents' health care. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, we use them all the time, whether it's to dispense wisdom, offer comfort, or make a point. Quotations come in handy, and everyone has their favorites. Now a conversation with the editor of Bartlett's Familiar Quotations about, and we'd like our listeners to chime in with their favorites, too, about their favorite quotes. Jeffrey O'Brien is also a former editor-in-chief of the Library of America, which puts out books under the theme of celebrating words that shaped America. He joins us now from NPR Studios in New York. And Jeffrey, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
And if our listeners want to chime in with quotes that have meant something to them over the years, give us a call. Our number, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. Or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. You know, I checked last night, and the edition of Bartlett's Familiar Quotations I have is the 14th edition that my parents gave me once upon a time at a birthday. You're working right now on the 19th edition.
Yes.
So I'm out of date, and I'm wondering what I'm missing.
Well, there have been changes going on, and it's been very exciting to work on the first on the 18th edition, which came out about 5 years ago, and now I'm deep into the 19th. You know, the Bartlett's originated in the mid 19th century in Boston. And it originally really focused primarily on English literature, biblical quotations, and that was about it, really, and some translations from Greek and Latin classics. So the scope of it has expanded steadily over time, and in these recent years, I've been focusing on trying to broaden it in quite a few ways. Obviously, I mean, women were severely underrepresented in earlier editions, if you check it out. And so, I mean, that's been an ongoing attempt. And I've also tried to bring in more voices translated from other languages, French, German, Japanese, a large number of writers, statesmen, and also to reckon with the fact that, for example, old editions of Bartlett's are full of verse, some of it great, some of it not so great, a lot of it just the popular poetry of its day. And, you know, the equivalent of that kind of light verse now really is song lyrics. So we've added quite a lot of that. And likewise, where quotations from important plays were prominently featured before, I've added a lot of dialogue from movies, sometimes from television.
Right.
And then, of course, beyond all that, there's the fact that we're living in, you know, the age of the internet and 24/7 news coverage. So just the sheer quantity of data that
right.
one has to think about is, you know, overwhelming but unavoidable.
We've already got some callers lining up here. I'm going to jump in and grab one right now, Jeffrey. This is Daniel from Wichita. Daniel, your favorite quote. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My favorite quote is from Martin Luther King Jr. It goes, "Darkness cannot drive out the dark, only light can do that." Hateness cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that.
Is that in the book, Jeffrey?
Well, let's see. I've got it right here. It certainly sounds familiar. I hope it's there. If it isn't, it will be in the next one. Let me see. We have a good number of quotes from Martin Luther King.
I was going to say, you don't have right off the top of your head all the 10,000 quotes in the book. just right at the tip of your tongue here.
Well, you know.
You're looking. Yeah.
I'm looking, but I'm not seeing that particular one. So
that'd be a good one.
But it does sound familiar, so it's quite possible that it is already slated for the 19th edition. But I've made a note here.
And, of course, that raises the obvious question here, which is how do you determine what you include and what gets left out here?
Well, it is an art and not a science. I mean, there is no absolute criterion. There's a lot of factors that we weigh. You know, the title Familiar Quotations implies that these are things that are not just great or significant, but that also have had some currency in the culture.
And that was John Bartlett's
title try to
for
take
it
a pretty
back in the
broad,
day, right?
Sorry?
That was John Bartlett's title for it, original title for it back in the day?
Yeah. And, you know, I've tried to broaden that a bit because there are quotes that are familiar perhaps in some areas but not everywhere within certain specialties, you know, whether it's science or painting or you know, I do try to always keep in mind that idea that it fundamentally it should be about words and ideas that really have had influence and that have pervaded the culture. And I look for people quoting other people. I mean, that's one of the ways I am alerted to things sometimes. If somebody is quoting someone,
right.
I take note of that. And very often, the moment I do, I find somebody else coming up with exactly the same quote. So that's just an indication of, okay, this is something
right.
that really has kind of gotten its hooks into.
You know, some of our KCUR personalities have offered their favorite quotes. Renee Blanche, a host of KCUR's Night Tides, says she's a longtime collector of quotes, as Night Tides listeners are aware. One of her favorites is, "If the only prayer you ever say in your entire life is thank you, it will be enough. That's from Meister Eckhart, a German theologian, philosopher, and mystic. What a beautiful sentiment that is.
Well, again, Meister Eckhart is in the book, but I'm not at all sure that that particular... Of course, he's one of these people where, you know, practically everything he said is has pretty incredible weight.
Michael Byers, KCUR announcer, offers this one: when the power of love overcomes the love of power, the world will know peace. That's from the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix.
Ah, that I do not think we have. So.
Yeah. Let's go back to some...
Yeah, we have more like, you know, Purple Haze and some some lyric fragments from Hendrix, but...
Jeanette from Overland Park. Jeanette, you're on Up to Date with Jeffrey O'Brien. He's the editor of Bartlett's Familiar Quotations. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you so much. This quotation is from Mother Teresa, now St. Teresa of Calcutta.
Mm-hmm.
She says, "What I can do, you cannot. What you can do, I cannot. But together, we can do something beautiful for God."
Hmm. Great line, Jeanette. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you so much.
Great.
Let's go to Chris from Lawrence. Chris, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about people's favorite quotations. Good morning.
Morning.
Go ahead.
I had one from the Chicago Times in 1861. They printed or said that it is a newspaper's duty to print the news and raise hell.
Well, there you go. I like that one, Chris. You're speaking to me very directly with that one. I appreciate that. Bill Anderson of KCUR's development team quoted the very quotable Yogi Berra, "It ain't over till it's over." Is that in the book, Jeffrey?
Well, we have a lot of Yogi Berra. The thing with Yogi Berra is, as he himself said, I really didn't say everything I said, which is one of his best quotes, actually. It ain't over till it's over. Yep.
That's there, right?
Dated 1973 next to It Gets Late Early Out There. You can observe a lot by watching. One of my favorites.
That's great. If you want to call in with your favorite quote, 816-235-2888 is the phone number here. You can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. My father offered this one: the secret to life is to have a task, something you devote your entire life to, something you bring everything to, every minute of the day for your whole life. And the most important thing is, it must be something you cannot possibly do. British sculptor Henry Moore, who died in 1986, said that.
One.
It's a great one, and his work can be found outside our Nelson Atkins Museum of Art here in town.
Yes, I've been there, and it's one of the best museums I've ever seen.
It's a great place. Yeah, tell us about how John Bartlett got started putting together these compilations of familiar quotations, Jeffrey.
Well, I think it was his hobby. He was a bookseller, and mm-hmm. He collected quotations, as many people do. And because he was involved in the book trade, he had the idea of putting them together in a little book that he sold to his local customers, and it burgeoned and survived, and has had, you know, an incredible history, really. And you know, I mean, what I love about Bartlett is it really is a tradition, and part of the tradition is being as scrupulous as possible about identifying sources and getting the quotations accurately.
And identifying the sources, you've got to do that, right, to include it in the book?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, there are certain things where you're never going to know exactly, but so many people say that somebody said something that we say attributed. Where there's a preponderance of evidence that, yes, this person did say that or something very like it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, where you're talking about, you know, table talk and conversational asides and... a lot of the best quotes fall into that category.
So ultimately, how much of this is Jeffrey O'Brien sort of picking something that appeals to you?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, I have particular interests and particular you know, writers that I respond to. But it isn't just my judgment. I mean, I work with, I consult with a lot of people. You know, the goal is to really, you know, cover a pretty wide range. And to bring in, you know, sometimes to bring in the unexpected, which sometimes just means bringing in categories that haven't been addressed as much. Well, for example, at Henry Moore quote, there weren't so many statements by artists, by painters, and I've tried to bring more of that in because there's a lot of great remarks, and likewise musicians, scientists. The earlier preponderance was much more, you know, literary and political and religious. I mean, those were the three large categories.
Some other KCUR personalities here. Suzanne Hogan, a reporter here, she quotes Walt Bodine, who hosted a talk show here for so many years. Walt once said, "You're a peach. Together, we're a pair." Okay. Sam Zeff, a reporter here, quotes Harry Truman, "The only thing new in the world is the history you do not know."
That sounds very familiar, and I hope it's in the book because I've certainly heard it before.
He also likes Eleanor Roosevelt's quote, "Courage is more invigorating than fear."
Ah, that I think we probably don't have, but
yeah.
Again, Eleanor Roosevelt is someone who was in the habit of making large statements, and so some of them are certainly in the book.
Let's go back to some phone calls here as we talk about people's favorite quotations. Cody from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm actually here to speak more to the power of quotes. That listener that just called in, he said, "Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that." Well, I'm a recovering drug addict. I'm 10.5 months clean from opiates.
Good for you.
And I go to a lot of groups, right? And my counselor used that quote on a group Friday morning.
Huh.
And it was actually a biblical quote. And I am not going to say Reverend Martin Luther King didn't say stuff from the Bible. But that just spoke to me so much, especially right after I just heard it, man.
Right.
And these quotes can change people's lives. And if I could, I'd like to leave you with a quote that my counselor says all the time.
Sure.
If you keep doing what you always did, you'll get what you always got.
Ha, there you go. Cody, keep it up, okay? I'm glad you called.
Thank you very much.
Thanks
for having me.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Tony from Belton. Tony, you're on Up to Date.
Yes, good morning. I'd like to leave this quote with you from a fellow Missourian, Samuel Clemens, who we know as Mark Twain. He said, "The more I learn about people, the more I like my dog." And I say amen to that.
Yes.
That's a little discouraging, though, I think, isn't it, Jeffrey?
No, but that's one of the most, yes, that has made the rounds, that line. Obviously strikes a chord.
Yes, it does. Let's go to Sharon from Lee Summit. Sharon, you're on Up to Date.
Hi.
This
quote was from Pastor John Hughes of First Baptist Church in Independence, and it stuck with me for over 40 years.
All right.
Here's the quote. "Never mistake the moment for the man."
Okay. That's a nice one,
all
Sharon.
Right.
Thank you. Yeah.
Bye.
Bye-bye. You know, Jeffrey, your work with Bartlett's is hardly your first large-scale editing job. You've done the Reader's Catalog of over 40,000 of the best books ever published and 2 volumes of American poetry for the Library of America.
Yes.
Is there really something appealing about taking on these monster editing jobs?
Well, I guess I enjoy it because I keep getting involved in these things. And the Bartlett's quotations project evolved out of another thing I did, the Bartlett's a poetry anthology, Poems for Occasions. Somehow led to my being involved with the Familiar Quotations, which of course has been the most long-term editorial project I've been involved with, and just keeps keeps being interesting, although it gets harder, you know, simply to find things that you haven't already thought of or that somebody else hasn't already thought of. But,
right.
You know, one of the advantages, of course, is that things keep happening and people keep saying and writing things. And, you know, we do try to keep abreast of things that look like they will probably stay around for a while.
Can readers and listeners submit ideas to you? Does that happen all the time?
Sure. I get suggestions. You can just send them in to Little Brown, you know, the publisher of Bartlett's. And
is there an email address that people can send? Or,
I don't actually have it handy here. But,
right.
Let's see.
Well, you look for it. I'll go back to some calls here. Leanne from Kansas City, Missouri. What's your favorite quote, Leanne?
Hi, am I on the air?
Yes, you are. Welcome.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. Yes, my favorite quote is from French author Anaïs Nin, who said, "Life shrinks or expands in proportion to one's courage."
Hmm. That's a good one, too. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's go to Gail from Kansas City, Missouri. Gail, good morning.
Good morning. My favorite quote is from Wayne Dyer.
Mm-hmm.
"When you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change." And we are such in a turmoil with everything that's going on around the world. But there's also a lot of stuff that is going on that is good. And we tend to forget that because of the overwhelming impact of the negativity that is currently in the air. And so in saying that, the other quote that I'd like to leave you with is from Adaya, and it is called, "All is well and all will be well."
Hmm.
Thank you.
Gail, I'm glad you called. Thank you. Those are great. And it's amazing how quickly, Jeffrey, the board lit up when we turned our conversation today to favorite quotations. A lot of people have them.
Oh, yes. This is one of the great sources because almost everyone carries a few of them around, and some people make a real hobby of it. And certain writers are wonderful sources because they love to quote other
right.
writers. And
you were looking for the email address for Little Brown, the publisher of Bartlett's Familiar Quotations.
I haven't actually found it in the old edition that I'm looking at here, but they are certainly findable on the internet.
And Bartlett's has a website, doesn't it? I was looking.
Yeah, and there's an app also
that
can be downloaded. It's not it functions a little bit differently from the printed book, but it provides access to the quotations.
Right. Let's go to John from Trimble, Missouri. John, good morning.
Good morning. How y'all doing?
Well, thank you.
I have kind of two of them put together, and I was told by the nice lady to get to the point real quick.
She does that.
Yeah, she's nice. Anyway, those who don't remember history are doomed to repeat it, and I may be paraphrasing it, but that is a quote from... Could you tell me who it is? But I don't remember. I'm driving in the car.
Yeah, pretty well-known line.
Yeah, I'd like to dovetail that into some pop. And Battlestar Galactica, this has happened before. It will happen again.
Yeah.
So, yes. And it all goes back to Faust.
Right. John, thanks for the call. Those who don't study history are doomed to repeat it. Jeffrey, is that...
Well, it's George Santayana.
Wow.
And let's see, 1905. And those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it.
Wow. And remind you, who was he again?
A philosopher.
Mm-hmm.
And occasional novelist and poet, but primarily a philosopher.
Richard from Kansas City, Missouri. You're on the air, Richard.
Good morning. Thanks. I like collecting quotes so much that I have like a couple of Word documents where I just, you know, cut and paste them and stick them in there.
Right.
But my recent favorite is George Orwell, who's getting quoted a lot these days. And the one I like of his is, "The further a society drifts from the truth, the more it will hate those who speak it."
Hmm.
And I think that's pretty appropriate.
Wow.
It probably always has been, but we're retesting that statement now.
Yeah, right.
Well, Orwell, you know, there are certain writers who, you know, you can always go back to them and find more. And Orwell is one of the most quotable writers of his time. And I constantly find new things that I want to add. I'm just looking at the page we have, which already has quite a few lines like, at 50, everyone has the face he deserves, which is one of the last things he wrote. Or just this line, which was the first line of a newspaper article he was writing in 1941. As I write, highly civilized human beings are flying overhead trying to kill me.
Right. John from Douglas County on the Kansas side, good morning.
Good morning. I don't know who exactly this is attributed to. I was told it was a Buddhist saying, but the phrase is, service to others is the rent we pay for our time on earth. And thank you.
I think I've heard that one before. That rings a bell, Jeffrey.
As to who said it first, I don't know offhand.
Yeah. We have so many callers here. Let's go Bianca from Lawrence. Bianca, nice to have you.
Hi. This is from Kate Wolf, singer-songwriter. Love can't give you everything, but it gives you what you need. Thank you.
Okay. That's good, too. We're talking about people's favorite quotations. Matthew from Lee's Summit, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. This is fairly familiar, and I'm not sure the source. I'm in the car and can't look it up. But I think in this era of uncivil interactions with one another, it's very apropos, and that is, they won't remember what you said, they won't remember what you did, but they will remember how you make them feel. And to respect other people in civil discourse, we should make each other feel validated.
Yeah, that's great.
People.
And before I lose our time here, mine, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Martin Luther King, although yes. I think others may have said it first, Jeffrey. Such a hopeful sentiment, I think.
Yeah. And it's in there somewhere. I'm not sure if he was he may have been paraphrasing a very ancient passage, possibly even from the Sanskrit. I'm not sure, but
Well, we're out of time. Jeffrey O'Brien is the former editor-in-chief of the Library of America series. He's the current editor of Bartlett's Familiar Quotations. I've got that book. I've got many of the Library of America volumes as well. And, Jeffrey, thanks so much for taking some time, and good luck in the next volume.
Well, thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
You bet. Thanks so much. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the program, I'll look at one effort to create oases in Kansas City's food deserts, and we'll take a look at how healthy residents of metro area counties are. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.